I'm Diana Penuchel, Associate Editor of American Libraries, the magazine of the American Library Association, and you're listening to Call Number with American Libraries. In this episode, we talk with experts in the field of preservation. CORE, a division of ALA, kicks off this year's Preservation Week on April 28th with the theme of preserving identities. The week's events aim to raise awareness of the role libraries and cultural institutions play in preservation. First, American Libraries Managing Editor Tara Dankowski speaks with Indigenous author Tracy Sorrell, the honorary chair of this year's Preservation Week. Sorrell is a former attorney who worked on Native Nations policy. She discusses preservation's part in telling stories. Next, I chat with Kathleen Monahan, Special Collections Public Services Supervisor at Boston Public Library, about the importance of security in preservation. Monahan co-chairs the Security Committee of the Rare Books and Manuscripts section of ALA's Association of College and Research Libraries. The committee recently updated its guidelines, and we learn more about those changes. Finally, American Libraries Associate Editor Megan Bennett speaks with Rosie Grayburn and Melissa Tidone, co-founders of the Poison Book Project, a joint initiative of Winterthur Museum, Garden, and Library, and the University of Delaware. They discuss their research on potentially toxic bookbinding materials from the 19th century. But first, an ad from our sponsor. ALA JobList is the number one source for jobs in library and information science and technology. If you're looking for a new job or are an employer who wants to advertise a job opening, JobList has you covered. Job seekers can refine and filter searches by position type, employer, location, and more. Post the resumes for hiring employers to view, and automate alerts to never miss a posting. Employers can rest easy knowing that ALA reaches the engaged professionals that you want to hire. It also simplifies recruiting by offering flat rate pricing and enhanced postings for increased visibility. ALA JobList, it's where job seekers and employers get results. Visit joblist.ala.org for more information or to begin your search today. This year's Preservation Week honorary chair is author Tracy Sorrell. Sorrell writes inclusive, historical contemporary fiction and nonfiction for youth. 8 of her books have received awards from the American Indian Library Association, and her 2020 title, Indian No More, won the American Indian Youth Literature Award. American Libraries Managing Editor Tara Dankowski speaks with Sorrell about preserving identities, promoting Native representation in literature, and managing cultural artifacts in an ethical way.
Your background in law and policy, I watched a video in which you said you got into writing around the time your son was born because you still weren't seeing contemporary and non-stereotypical representations of Cherokee and Native Nations people in their daily life and children's books. Do you feel as if this representation in publishing has evolved since even you've started writing books? And as an author, what would you want to see the publishing industry do better to break down barriers and commit itself to inclusion?
I do feel representation has evolved in the past decade since I've started writing. There's a heck of a lot more to do in terms of having broader representation because there are nearly 600 Native Nations in the United States, and we definitely do not have books that represent, you know, even 100 different Native Nations, let alone nearly 600, right? So I am encouraged, though, that steps have been taken to look at where we need to focus on, and that publishers are saying, okay, we're prioritizing books created by Native writers and illustrators, people that are connected to those communities. If someone's not Native writing about Native authors, you see many more publishers saying, you know, who have you worked with? How are you connected to this Native nation? Because there are still problematic books that are out in the world every year for young people. Thankfully, not as many, but I'd love us to get to zero because in this day and age, there's just no place for that.
You've been named honorary chair of this year's Preservation Week, which will take place April 28th to May 4th. This year's theme is preserving identities. What drew you to this role or this theme?
Well, we're in a new time and era. Right. I mean, libraries, archives, museums in the 21st century can't continue the abuses and disrespect that Native nations have experienced, you know, thus far. So technology and Native nations with incredible staff and facilities demand a new era. We have all kinds of collaborations that are in place, but we need a lot more and a lot of cooperation in how collections are accessed and housed and certainly displayed moving forward.
In your Preservation Week statement, you talk about some deep experiences that you've had with libraries and archives as part of your higher education and past internships. I was struck by your account seeing cultural items in a storage facility belonging to the National Museum of the American Indian. Could you talk about the impressions, you know, these past experiences have left on you, and if you're drawing from them in your role as honorary chair?
Definitely. I remember vividly one of my first experiences was being an undergraduate. I'm a first-generation college graduate. I was a received my bachelor's at UC Berkeley, which has the famous, you know, Phoebe Hearst Museum of Anthropology on campus, thousands of ancestral remains. That was a subject of protest when I was a student there in the early 90s, and they still haven't gotten all the remains returned. You know, they're still engaged in problematic. I mean, learning as an undergraduate that there was a man, you know, Ishi, Native man, who lived at the museum as a living exhibit. I could not fathom, you know, and so that was really the first experience I had. And I was flabbergasted that people within ethnography, within anthropology could, you know, amass these collections and, again, not have any sense of respect and, you know, they were building careers. I mean, let's just be simple. They were building careers. And they really did not care about the harm that they were doing. And that was obvious. And so then, you know, I go to a place like the National Museum of the American Indian, whose collection was started by, you know, obviously a non-Native man, George Christoph High, and since then has been added to by Native staff at the museum. And just walking in to the storage facility, which was originally in the Bronx in this brick building, and seeing false face masks of, you know, the Haudenosaunee people on the wall, which should never be displayed and, you know, had put draping over them. And then them pulling out drawers of Cherokee Nation and thinking to myself, why don't we have that at home? Why aren't we seeing these things? Why are they here? And how do these people see these things? So it just made me think, wow, these folks need to operate with more of our ethical framework as a focus. Let's look at respect. Let's look at relationship. Let's look at reciprocity and not really the Western values of, you know, accumulation and wanting to quantify and examine everything and study skull sizes or, again, disturb someone's gravesite and also just the humanizing language that often accompanies exhibits. From that point, I was like, okay, so much more can be done here to show respect and to build strong relationships. And that's why I say in the 21st century, I don't see how we cannot be committed to evolving to a very different place.
What do you think are some practices that libraries, museums, and archives can do to make their collections preserved identities more accessible for those whose identities are being represented, displayed, or held by an institution?
Well, certainly we've seen recently, like the American Museum of Natural History in New York, you know, has had to cover up exhibits where they weren't being respectful of NAGPRA. I mean, at a minimum, everyone needs to get all of the human remains. I mean, NAGPRA was passed a long time ago, a couple of decades ago now, and yet they have, you know, really ignored the federal law in getting funerary objects and human remains and other personal effects back to the tribes. That needs to be done ASAP. Also, respect for what is displayed and shown to the public. So don't display items or allow access to photos, recordings, et cetera, to those that those are not intended to have access to them. There's medicine songs or bundles, et cetera. Follow the protocols that the Native nations are giving you, have respect for that. And there are some institutions that have done that, and it's wonderful because, again, you're recognizing the humanity of Native Nations, and you're recognizing that they have protocols in place that are there to respect those objects, which they consider and are a very much a living part of their ancestry, and their present, and their future. And then definitely deaccession, you know, and permanently loan as a secondary option, you know, cultural patrimony and objects back to Native Nations. That is not a difficult thing to do, but it certainly is, again, a great way to show that you're operating in an ethical manner, and you respect the fact that Native Nations have, you know, their own ways of caring for these. And so many of them have their own museums and archives and cultural centers. They have access to the technology. So many of them have wonderful institutions. Like a couple of years ago, I was out at the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde in what is northwest corner of Oregon now, and they had their items on loan from the British Museum, right? And so, you know, when you think, again, the process and how difficult it is to get things, you know, on loan, et cetera, I mean, they had managed to do this internationally. So I think that also just changing the mindset of like, oh, once again, tribes aren't up for this. They absolutely are more, you know, and so just to stop that very limited thinking of what can be done and approaching this with humility about there's a lot that we can do in partnership. And again, not just coming from this Western model of like, we're better at caring for these things. We can take care of these things, et cetera. That's simply not reality. When you think about, you know, again, photographs or recordings and things that are appropriate for the public to have access to, I mean, definitely making sure that Native Nations know what's in the catalog, because those things should be easily accessible to their citizens. You know, it could be family members' photos, it could be recordings of interviews or people singing or whatever. There's a numerous things that we can do online, and certainly photos of those things that are okay to be photographed and displayed should be. And that should be a priority in terms of funding, is making sure that those things are accessible online to Native Nations. And if it's okay to be accessible to a broader public, then they're made available to a broader public as well.
Are there any programs or activities coming up for Preservation Week that you'd like to mention?
There are two webinars planned to take place during that week. Check at the preservationweek.org website as the week draws closer for details. I'll be moderating one of the webinars. I'll also be reading Being Home, my upcoming picture book with Caldecott medalist Michaela Goad from Penguins Cocula Books, and that'll be available for a limited time online. So the recording of the reading and an interview with me will be posted during Preservation Week, in addition to, like I say, another webinar I'm moderating. So I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it very much.
ALA Job List is the number one source for jobs in library and information science and technology. If you're looking for a new job or are an employer who wants to advertise a job opening, Job List has you covered. Job seekers can refine and filter searches by position type, employer, location, and more, post their resumes for hiring employers to view, and automate alerts to never miss a posting. Employers can rest easy knowing that ALA reaches the engaged professionals that you want to hire. It also simplifies recruiting by offering flat rate pricing and enhanced postings for increased visibility. ALA Job List, it's where job seekers and employers get results. Visit joblist.ala.org for more information or to begin your search today. Last year, the Security Committee of ACRL's Rare Books and Manuscripts section revised its guidelines regarding the security of special collections materials. Kathleen Monahan, co-chair of the committee, highlights some of those guideline changes and provides tips to improve security at any size institution. Can you share with us some highlights or the biggest changes to the newly revised guidelines regarding security in special collections?
The Security Committee at the Rare Books and Manuscripts section of ACRL revises the security guidelines every 5 years. And I should mention that there were different co-chairs who were doing the bulk of the revisions. I want to make sure that credit is shared. We kind of looked at a number of factors when looking at revisions for the guidelines. One of the things we were interested in is making sure that we are acknowledging the role racism and bias plays in security and trying to explicitly mention that in the guidelines and think about ways that we can create the guidelines in an attempt to minimize racism and bias as much as possible, knowing that they are prevalent. The other things we are looking at as well was trying to make the guidelines inclusive of many different material formats. The guidelines previously focused heavily on rare books, but many of the institutions using these guidelines have rare books, yes, but they also have archival collections, papers, lots of different objects. Some of the guidelines that make sense for books, for example, making sure everything is individually cataloged, does not scale when you're thinking about entire archival collections. We went through thinking about how do we make sure that these work across formats. We also have been hearing a lot from folks that they want to make sure the guidelines scale to different institutions. So some institutions may have a single archivist or a single librarian in charge of the collections, and others may have a staff of 20 to 30, including dedicated security staff. We wanted to acknowledge that often the guidelines are aspirational. They are not a one-size-fits-all document, and instead lay out, here are some principles to think about, and here are some questions to keep in mind, and really encourage institutions that the most important thing is to think about this in advance of a crisis, to have a security plan written out to make sure that every staff know it, and they are, for example, not relying on individual judgment over what to do when someone strikes them as suspicious, but instead having an pre-plan of what could happen, and then knowing that that plan fits their particular both institution size, but also the particular community they serve. As much as we have a duty to safeguard materials, we also have a duty to serve our communities, not harm our communities, and making sure that the, security plan that you come up with really fits your particular situation.
What were some of the new equitable or inclusive considerations the Security Committee was keeping in mind when making their revisions?
One of the things that we were looking at was making sure that we are acknowledging that racism and bias are in there. And we really, really, really talked about being careful about how to implement security procedures because they can also impact the communities that use the collections. Some recommendations that I think were a bit firmer in previous guidelines, such as asking for government IDs or doing bag checks. We now say some institutions may choose to do that, but to make sure that matches with the people you are serving and making sure that that matches with your intentions of use. We also really focus on having very specific and intentional language about when you might choose to contact outside law enforcement, including choosing to never contact law enforcement, with the idea that you want a written policy, so it is once again not on an individual staff member's judgment to think this is a moment where I need to bring police into a situation or believing that a particular person may have a subjective idea of being viewed as suspicious or dangerous. And we really focused on the idea that institutions should prioritize the recovery of materials rather than focusing necessarily on punitive measures. Our role as librarians is to make sure materials are recovered and served.
What needs did the committee see over the last 5 years that they felt needed to be addressed?
Yes, so these guidelines are revised every 5 years. Some revisions are larger than others, and this was one of the larger revisions. The revision process started actually before I was on the committee. I believe it started around 2019, 2020. And so much of the wider conversations in our field and in the world about, the racial reckonings after George Floyd's murder began touching on this as well. There was a lot of voices within our field, both within our committee as well as just in the field in general, saying that we really need to take a hard look at our guidelines and think about how to make them more inclusive. And so that kind of pushed the idea that this would be a larger than normal revision to the guidelines.
So how does an institution's security infrastructure relate to their ability to effectively preserve materials? How do security and preservation work together hand in hand?
So security and preservation really have the same goal at the end of the day, which is to make sure that materials not only are available for use today, but are available for use 10, 50, 100 years from now. The security guidelines are really focused around the type of material that's found in special collections, which is, you know, cannot be replaced often or is extremely hard to replace once gone. So the way I personally think about security is that I have the same duty to the patrons who want to see my material today as the patrons who want to see the material of my institution 20, 50 years from now. And I think that kind of long-term thinking is also the same in preservation. So in the same way that you want to make sure that you have environmental controls, because that can harm materials over time, making sure things like your facility only has a couple of access points and you know where they are can also serve your material over time.
How can smaller or rural libraries apply these guidelines to protect their materials?
The most important thing to do with security is just to have a conversation and think about it with your institution and with whatever stakeholders make sense in your institution. The guidelines call for a security committee, which may be the staff at your library. It may be you and your board of directors, or, you know, depending on your exact situation. And I think the goal, once again, is that you want to think about what makes most sense for the materials you hold and what makes most sense for the communities you serve. And as long as you are having that conversation and making a plan that makes sense for your particular context, that I think goes a long step towards security, and is going to look very different for a smaller library with smaller collections than it is going to be for the Library of Congress. And that's perfectly fine. And the goal of the guidelines really are to give people ideas to think about and ideas to talk about that you can then adapt to your institution, no matter what size your institution is.
ALA Joblist is the number one source for jobs in library and information science and technology. If you're looking for a job or are an employer who wants to advertise a job opening, Joblist has you covered. Job seekers can refine and filter searches by position type, employer, location, and more, post their resumes for hiring employers to view, and automate alerts to never miss a posting. Employers can rest easy knowing that ALA reaches the engaged professionals that you want to hire. It also simplifies recruiting by offering flat rate pricing and enhanced postings for increased visibility. ALA Joblist, it's where job seekers and employers get results. Visit joblist.ala.org for more information or to begin your search today. In our final segment, we talk the Poison Book Project, which focuses on identifying potentially toxic pigments in 19th century bookbinding and the ways to safely handle these collections. American Libraries Associate Editor Megan Bennett speaks with Rosie Grayburn and Melissa Tadone. Grayburn is head of the Scientific Research and Analysis Laboratory at Winterthur Museum, Garden, and Library, an affiliated associate professor in the Winterthur University of Delaware program in art conservation. Tadone is Assistant Professor for Library and Archives Conservation at University of Delaware and Associate Director of the Winterthur University of Delaware Program in Art Conservation. They talk about how the project began, their findings thus far, and the dangers you might encounter when working with these artifacts.
So my name is Melissa Tadone.
And my name is Rosie Graben.
Can you share a little bit about the origins of this project?
The project began, I think, as many research projects do, with a little bit of serendipity. A book called Rustic Adornments for Homes of Taste by Shirley Hibbard was selected for an exhibition at Winterthur. And the book was in pretty rough condition, the binding, the boards were falling off. And so it came to the Library Conservation Lab. At that time, I was head of library conservation at Winterthur. And so it came to my lab for treatment. And I just happened to be reading a book about arsenical wallpapers that were produced in the 19th century in England while I was working on this book. And the book was very bright green. And, you know, it was one of those little moments of serendipity where I thought, oh, this couldn't possibly be that arsenical green pigment, could it? And, you know, I'm just very fortunate that Winterthur is the kind of place where when you have a random question like that, we have the staff expertise and equipment to be able to answer it. So I took the book to Rosie and...
Yeah, so we have a suite of equipment at Winterthur that is very well equipped for analyzing types of pigments. So we normally look at paintings, painted surfaces, ceramics, and it's the first time I'd looked at a book. So we use the same techniques that we would have used for other types of materials that we analyze in the museum and the library. And we found that it was a pigment called emerald green, which is copper acetoarsenite. So it contains arsenic, which is a toxic heavy metal pigment. But I think the most crucial part of this was that the pigment was in a way shedding from the surface. So Melissa, when she was looking at the book and examining it, you could tell that it wasn't very well bound. And so not only was it arsenical, but it was also not very well bound to the book. And so when you were handling it, it could offset. So thus started the Poison Book Project, because we could see that the risks were elevated compared to maybe other similar types of materials.
How prevalent is or was this issue in bookbinding, and what period of history does it span?
So, you know, I mentioned that we were really inspired by the arsenical wallpapers that were being produced in the 19th century. Concurrent with our research on these 19th century bindings, unbeknownst to us at the time, there was also a group looking at bespoke bindings from the 17th century. So four parchment bindings were discovered at the University of Southern Denmark and the Smithsonian Library. So Thomas Delby at the University of Southern Denmark and Ali Alvis and Vanessa Haight Smith and a larger team at Smithsonian were looking into arsenic on these parchment bindings. And it turned out those bindings were painted green, but it was actually a yellow mineral pigment called orpiment, which is an arsenic-based pigment as well, that was used. It was mixed with a blue dye like indigo to make the green color. And so those would have been bespoke book bindings that were, you know, made specifically for those books. But it was good evidence that there are toxic materials that were being used in bookbinding. And certainly we know that arsenical mineral pigments like orpiment and realgar have been used since antiquity to make material culture. So I think that what made the Poison Book Project unique and made us think that this is worth pursuing was simply the scale on which those toxic materials were being used to produce material culture. You know, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, suddenly the scale was just absolutely unprecedented. But in fact, humans have used toxic materials to make stuff for as long as we've been making stuff.
Since you started this project, what has the research looked like? What are some of the highlights or discoveries you feel like you've made in the last several years?
Well, maybe taking it from the beginning, it's really evolved over the years. We originally took a very broad survey approach because we didn't know where the arsenic was coming from. And so we originally started with a rainbow of books. We looked at all English language books and bound in cloth in the Victorian era, which was a lot of our collection. And then we slowly kind of realized that, okay, the arsenic is really compartmentalized to green, and it's within the state range. And so from then, we've been narrowing down surveys, and other local institutions have allowed us to go and analyze their books. So we've been going about finding these books visually to start with. So again, looking at the dates, looking at the colors, and then to confirm the presence of arsenic, we have been using a portable analytical instrument called X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy, which helps us to identify the presence of arsenic and copper. And that's a very quick technique. It's quite common in conservation. It uses X-rays to give kind of an elemental fingerprint. And so we can very quickly and easily tell that arsenic and copper are present. If we do detect the presence of arsenic, then we do an additional technique on top of that if we are in the lab. And that technique is called Raman spectroscopy. So there's like a level of different ways you can go about finding these books. And we've been testing all of these different ways because we have those resources. So going from visual analysis, bibliographic information, and then analytical approaches as well.
And then thanks to the partner institutions who have also been analyzing their collections and sharing data, we've really come to understand that it's not just book cloth. We think that the emerald green book cloth, and when emerald green is used on the text block edges, so the edges of the pages where you would turn the pages, that's where emerald green is the most dangerous because it's the most likely to offset onto your hands. But we are also finding emerald green in many other components as well. So on spine labels, on decorative onlays that decorate the cover of the bindings, on leather onlays. We just found some leather onlays a few days ago, on end papers inside the book. So it's really broadened our understanding of all the different places in a book binding that arsenic pigment could be used.
What are the symptoms that can arise from short or long-term use of these poisonous books or these books with toxic materials?
Actually, there haven't been any long-term studies to examine the specific health effects of exposure to emerald green bindings, surprisingly. Or to toxic materials in library collections or book bindings at all. But what we do know is we do know the risks associated with these different heavy metals. So for example, we know from the chemical literature that emerald green pigment is a known carcinogen. We also know that you can have long-term health effects from exposure to lead over long periods of time. We know that chromium and mercury are hazardous and can cause possible long-term health effects. So those are the risks. What we're really interested in is trying to understand the exposure. So even though something may be very toxic, if you're not being exposed to it through your work or when you're in a library and handling these objects, then it's not really a hazard, or it's the hazard, the risk is really, really low. So as I said, the long-term studies are not quite there, but some of our colleagues at other libraries have done some similar work. So our colleagues at Northwestern Libraries, they looked at how much of this dust, so arsenic or lead containing dust, is present in the air. So when you're in a library and breathing, are you taking on any of this heavy metal dust? And the answer is no. Very, very, I think, very low against the detection limit. So that's not a risk that people are concerned about. Really, the risk is coming from the handling of the arsenical bindings because of the offset of the pigment onto your hands. But in terms of inhaling, the risk isn't there at all.
We interact rather intimately with books, right? Like we curl up with them in bed. We eat or drink a cup of coffee while we're reading them. And so it's in that kind of interaction that there's risk that you might be handling a book, unknowingly getting arsenic on your hands, and then maybe you're rubbing your face or you're biting your nails because, you know, it's a really dramatic scene in the book, or, you know, you're accidentally ingesting it as you drink a cup of coffee. And so we really feel like the biggest hazard that these books represent is simply not knowing that there is a hazard there. And that once people do know and are aware, it's very easy to just change your behavior, and very small changes can help keep you safe.
When you're doing this work, you find that there is a poisonous book or book with hazardous materials. What happens from there? What do you all do with those materials? And what do you recommend other libraries or institutions do with those materials?
We've done a lot of training, had a lot of conversations with our colleagues at Winterthur. So everyone knows now if they see bright green anything, they don't touch it without gloves. They put on a pair of nitrile gloves and they bring it to Rosie's lab and put it in the queue for analysis. And if it is found to contain arsenic, then for the book bindings, we bag them in a polyethylene plastic bag that has a zip top, which, you know, they're so affordable. This is like a very accessible way to store a so-called poison book, but it's going to contain any of that shedding pigment. So it can't offset onto other surfaces or onto you when you're handling it. And we have safety labels as well. There's a system called the Globally Harmonized Label System for hazards that has these pictograms so that even if you don't speak a language, like you can recognize the hazard. And so we use that on our labels. And then we also, you know, list some safe handling recommendations on the label as well. And then at our library, we have the luxury of being able to move those books to a special area in the rare book vault. So all of our emerald green bindings are stored together. And that's because in a collection emergency situation, you've isolated all of the same kind of hazard in the same place. So we have, you know, signage on the shelf and also, you know, the label on each individual binding, just to make sure anyone that goes near these books understands what the hazard would be.
Do you have any additional resources or pieces of advice you'd like to offer librarians?
Well, I'd just really like to encourage people to visit the website because we do share a lot of the information that can be found in our published papers in a sort of stripped down, easy to digest way on the website. That is meant to be a resource for just the general public as well as colleagues. And so people can find information there about all the bindings that we have positively identified as containing arsenic. They can find more specific safe handling and storage recommendations there. They can find a bibliography from the BibTalks group of articles that we've been publishing on a range of topics related to bibliotoxicology. And they can find the email address where they can request a color swatch bookmark. So,
yes. And also just don't panic. All the information is there. If the information is not there that you need, then you can contact us through the website. We're just really glad that we're raising awareness and we have developed these pretty robust steps that people can take.
We like to think it's a great resource and we're updating it and improving it all the time.
Next episode, we're discussing sustainability. Is there a story or topic you'd like us to cover? Let us know via email or social media. Thanks for listening.